This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Terrence Jeffrey on the line with us. He's the editor-in-chief of the Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com. Terrence, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Big news here. It's been all over the media the last couple of days, the last week or so, that in Japan and then also in Wisconsin, apparently, they have figured out a way by using a virus or using DNA guns to modify four genes in a normal cell. They've been using skin cells to basically flip off the I know what I am part of that cell and turn it into I don't know what I am yet, which is basically what a stem cell is. I can become anything. And this has got a lot of people very excited. Your take on this, Terrence?
Well, it is a great thing because for two reasons scientifically. One, now you can make stem cells without having to kill a human embryo. And secondly, because one of the barriers to moving forward with a human embryo research for developing stem cells is a human embryo has its own DNA. It belongs to a certain person. And if you try and use that to treat someone else, their body will naturally reject it, which is why some people were arguing for cloning human embryos for therapeutic purposes. So I think this is a great step forward. I just say, really, the principles that ought to be applied to this are the Nuremberg principles, which were developed by the U.S. military tribunal that tried Nazi doctors after World War II. And one of the principles was that you can never do research on a human subject unless that research is aimed at helping that subject, him or herself. In other words, you cannot harm one person and try to benefit another person.
Right, or as you say in your article, it's never necessary to compromise ethics by destroying life in order to achieve scientific aims. So of the hundreds of thousands of stem cells this year, embryos this year, fertilized embryos, what you would define as human life, that are going to be poured down the drain in vitro fertilization clinics across the United States, should we be tracking down those doctors and nurses and clinicians and lab technicians and frankly, you know, fathers and mothers who you know, submitted their sperm and eggs to be fertilized, to be then implanted in a woman's womb so that they can have a baby. Should we be tracking them all down and subjecting them to the death sentence because they're complicit in murder?
Well, now, first of all,
according to the Nuremberg principles,
well,
we should.
Let me answer your question. I will answer it. First of all, it's not what I define as human life. Either there's a human life present from the moment of conception or there isn't. It is a matter of...
I'm using your language.
You want me to answer your question? Either there is a human being present from the moment of conception or there isn't. Now, that question is a scientific question that's already been answered by embryologists. There's no doubt that an embryo is a unique and individual human life. So if someone deliberately...
It's not a scientific question. It's a legal question
because we're talking about legal punishments
for people.
Right. No, wait a minute. First of all, there is a question of is this a human being or not? And that is settled by science. When conception happens, there is a unique individual human being that is alive. Now, if someone deliberately kills a human being, is that a crime? Yes, that is a crime.
Okay, so you're saying that anybody who goes to an in vitro, you've got a couple, they can't have kids because the woman's tubes, typically this is the most
right.
common one, her tubes have been scarred up by an infection or something like that.
Right.
And so they put a needle into her ovaries and they pull out a couple of eggs. And they get his sperm from the husband. They mix them together in a petri dish. They fertilize some of those eggs. They look at them. They take what they think is the best one or two or three, and they implant them into her womb. She has a baby. Now they've got a couple of fertilized eggs left over. They pour them down the sink, which is what they do.
Right.
And we're talking about hundreds of thousands a year that get poured down the sink. You think that couple should be put in front of a firing squad in the state of Utah, should be put in the gas chamber in the state of California, should be subject to lethal injection at the federal level?
No, let me tell you exactly.
Because they're complicit in murder.
So let me tell you exactly what I think. I think in vitro fertilization is wrong. It shouldn't take place for exactly the reason you describe. You are irresponsibly creating human life. Yes, I do believe that human life should only be created in the way God intended, which is through the natural reproductive processes of a man.
How do you know
woman?
God didn't intend for us to figure out how to do in vitro fertilization?
It's because what you're doing is you're creating a situation where you wantonly discard human life.
But how do you know that that's not what God intended? If you want to use what God intended as the referential base.
Let me explain why I believe that.
Where in the Bible does it say no in vitro cells?
Hold on. I think this is a basic principle of natural law. I think any parents, if they're going to bring a child into the world, have to have responsibility for that child. Now, if the situation is now that you create a child in a petri dish and then you put it in a freezer with the contemplation that some of those children you create will be surplus, and as you say, you will wash them down the drain, that is irresponsible. You're bringing into this world a life that you do not intend to nurture and take responsibility for. Yes, in fact, it is an abuse of that human life. No question about it.
So you think that people should be, okay. Now, at least you're intellectually consistent. I disagree with you, but at least you're intellectually consistent here, Terrence. You say it's never necessary to compromise ethics by destroying life in order to achieve scientific aims. My mentor, Gottfried Mueller, this man who is the founder of a nonprofit organization in Germany, Kinder and Jungen Hilsberg Solom, was very concerned about vivisection, the destruction of animals for human research, for research that would benefit humans. He created an institute, the Salem Research Institute in Germany, hired hundreds of scientists on a part-time basis from all over the world and had them contribute articles on how research done on tissue culture in a petri dish was actually more effective than research done on animals to do everything from testing cosmetics to looking for cancer,
sure,
cancer cures. And published this and spent an enormous amount of time traveling all around the world pitching this to companies saying stop using lab animals. It was actually quite successful and saved the lives of probably tens of millions of lab animals, but there is still vivisection going on. Are you opposed to the destruction of all life for the benefit of humans or just human life?
I think, first of all, I want you to know, I was raised in a family where both my parents were doctors. My mother and dad, who are both deceased, were doctors. They were medical scientists. My father was a pathologist, he was involved in this kind of stuff in his life. I think that every single creature needs to be treated with ordinate respect. Now, look, does that mean that some creatures I believe that man has a duty to use the created world around us in a proper way.
So do you use, or your family, for example, use cosmetics that you come from companies that don't test them on the eyes of rabbits?
I don't know that for certain. I have three daughters, and I don't know that for certain.
Why not be as concerned about that? I mean, we're talking about the destruction, the wanton destruction of life for purely economic purposes.
You know what? That's a good question. And if I were made aware of it, I would not patronize a company that was abusing animals.
Well, let me suggest you spend, 5 minutes over at the PETA site, or many others. What about the human studies that are done in third world countries? I don't know if you saw the Constant Gardener.
Well, that is an absolute outrage.
So you think that we should be going after our pharmaceutical
companies? I think, yes.
Why not the level of outrage over at Cybercast News Service about these kinds of issues rather than just, stem cells?
I tell you what, we do write about these kind of issues, and your readers ought to visit cnsnews.com and see about some of the things we write about. And absolutely, one of the things, I'll tell you, I'd like to give you the exact reference for this, one of the reasons, for example, that has been discussed in some medical journals about why they would want to make, for example, Gardasil, the HPV vaccine, mandatory not just for girls but for boys, is because, for one thing, it increases the market for the people who are selling it and creates more of an incentive for the people who are producing it. But secondly, also because it breaks down cultural barriers to future vaccines.
This is the same argument. In essence, this is the same argument that Catholics made for a long time against the use of all forms of birth control, particularly condoms. That is still being made by people who are opposed to condoms being available.
Well, no, what the Catholic Church says, and I am a Catholic, is that you should not engage in sex outside of marriage. and that married people should not engage in...
I mean, this was the argument that was made before the Supreme Court back in 1964 in the case in Connecticut.
Griswold
versus Connecticut. That a married couple, it should be a crime, it was a crime for a married couple to have a condom in their house. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't say that that's illegal. And the argument that was made was, well, you know, the availability of condoms is going to encourage people to have sexually risky behavior. And you're saying, you know, the availability of this virus is going to encourage that.
I think there's no doubt that in the last several decades that promiscuous behavior has increased.
In our society,
there's been a cost paid for it.
Yeah, I don't disagree. We disagree as to the reasons for that. But, Terrence, we'll have to continue this conversation. I'd love to get into capital punishment with you sometime, too.
All right.
We'll have you back. Terrence Jeffrey, editor-in-chief, CNSNews.com. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Well, I guess the one question that I'm going to have to ask Terrence next time around is, if in vitro fertilization involves the destruction of human life, by his definition, and if the law says that anybody who destroys human life, that's called killing, is subject to the death penalty, which form of death penalty would be most appropriate to use against somebody who has in vitro fertilization? And maybe a corollary is if you've got a couple who used in vitro fertilization to get pregnant, and that's a crime because it involves the destruction of human embryos, and say the woman's 3 months pregnant, and you put her and her husband to death because, after all, they've committed killing, then do you wait for her to give birth before you put her to death, or do you do it before she's given birth? A lot of ethical questions here coming up as a consequence of all this stuff. Strange stuff in the world, by the way. Some of it really crazy. Ron Paul's been endorsed by a brothel owner. That's only half of the crazy news regarding Ron Paul. The brothel owner has endorsed Ron Paul because he seems to be of the opinion that Ron Paul was in favor of legalizing brothels all over the country. Which, of course, is the official libertarian position, that this should be an issue for local communities, not for the federal government or for even states. As I so often say, libertarians are Republicans who want to get laid and get high. But oddly, when Ron Paul was asked about it, he said that if he was a local official, he would vote to ban brothels. So small solace for the Bunny Ranch, I guess. And a former member of the Singing Senators, by the way, just an interesting little heads up, of the four original members of the Singing Senators, John Ashcroft is gone, now Trent Lott is gone. The only member left standing is Larry Craig. But speaking of John Ashcroft, another crazy alert, John Ashcroft he gave a speech and took some questions afterwards, and the first question was waterboarding, if he was willing to be subjected to it. And he said, sure. He said, the things that I can survive, if it were necessary for me to do them, I would do it. So, we now know, according to John Ashcroft, that if you survive something, it wasn't torture. Right. This is absolutely, absolutely bizarre making. By the way, if you want to drop into our live chat room, we've changed our website. It's still TomHartman.com, but we're making some changes in the website, and... So if you don't find the chat room with the old link that you used to have, because the URL has changed, just go to TomHartman.com and click on the chat room link. And, you know, it takes a minute or so to load because it's a Java applet, but it'll get you in there. So step by step, that's how you do it. Now, get back to this whole issue of abstinence education and stem cells and when does life begin and all these other issues that frankly, I think, and this has been my position all along on this, is that we need to have a conversation about this in the United States. We have not had a serious, legitimate, honest, I'll share my opinion, you share your opinion, maybe we'll agree to disagree, and we're going to figure out how to make law based on that. We haven't had that kind of discussion about this issue, frankly, since the 1970s. And the consequences of that has been that the decisions are being made by judges. And this is something that the right decries, and frankly, I think the left should decry, that the decisions about when does life begin legally, when does human life begin, when do you have a person, are legal decisions. They have to do with we as a society collectively saying, okay, this is our definition. And it may be different from the position of the Mormons, or it may be different from the position of the Baptists, or it may be different from the position of the Catholics, or it may be different from the position of the Hindus. I mean, it may be different from the position of the atheists and the secularists. Fill in the blank. We need to have a conversation about that. Which leads, of course, to the conversation about whether or not we should have abortion, and if so, at what stages do you begin putting limits on it? Now, we did have that conversation 30 years ago. We ended up with abortion laws that basically said that abortion is legal except as you get closer and closer to viability, it gets harder and harder, more and more illegal, or closer and closer to illegality, to the point where if a child can exist outside the womb, then that child can't be aborted unless there's some compelling medical reason. And again, these vary from state to state, but now we have all of these de facto bans on abortion, and as much as, you know, providers are not available. And then we get into the issue of how do you prevent, you know, again, Terrence brought up the issue of the papilloma virus vaccine. How do you prevent pregnancies in the first place? And all the available evidence is that you do it with good, competent sex education for young people before they're sexually active. And yet the same folks who are saying, no, we've got to make abortions illegal, who you would think would be opposed to pregnancies, you know, unwanted pregnancies, are fighting sex education. Very strange. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You know it's nothing new. Bad news never had good timing. Then the circle of your friends will defend the silver lining. Pain throws your heart to the ground. Love ties the whole thing around. No, it won't.
34 minutes past the hour. Hey, tomorrow night, I'm flying to Los Angeles. Tomorrow night, I will be there. And in Santa Monica, tomorrow night, I'll be at the Barnes & Noble on 3rd Street Promenade at 7:30 p.m., giving a speech about and then signing my new book, Cracking the Code. And day after tomorrow night, Friday night, I'll be in Oak Park, California, the Ventura County Democrats Speakers Series, from 7 to 9 p.m. It's at 1000 Cannon Road in Oak Park, California. That's Friday night. And then on December 14th, I'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota at 7 p.m. at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at the Kauffman Memorial Union. Very much looking forward to that. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Wayne in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hang on just a second here, Wayne. I've got to change the mode here on my call screening software so that I can actually put you on the air. There we go. Hey, Wayne, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I have a two-part question. Generally speaking, do progressives feel that there are too many abortions performed in America today?
Yes.
And, okay, that's a straight answer.
I have never met anybody who is in favor of abortion.
Okay.
Never. Not a single person. And, you know, I know women who've had abortions. I know couples who have had abortions, and I know a lot of people who have never had abortions. I don't know anybody who, you know, period.
Okay, well, I appreciate
the
frankness and the, you know, because I agree as well. I guess the other part of the question then would be, are there any progressive planks that are being spoken of? Because you were talking about a conversation that's needed to consider things like stages and limits. So are there any progressive planks that encourage more of a culture of life than the currently existing culture?
Yeah, and there are things that have to do with those things that will drive down the number of pregnancies. I mean, the Democratic basically talking point from the last election, previous elections on this issue has been that, you know, abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And the "and rare" part is really important. And if you want to make abortions rare, then what you need to do is you need to enhance sex education. I mean, it's just the very much the bottom line. And sex education is an important part of this thing because it reduces the probability of unwanted pregnancies. And abstinence-only education increases the probability of unwanted pregnancies. And that's been so well demonstrated in the United States over the last 30 years, and not just in the United States, but in other countries around the world. And yet, this is still something that the Republican Party and the Bush administration are hanging on to, this abstinence-only education, sex education, that just basically says, no, we're not going to talk about sex, we're not going to talk about birth control, we're not going to talk about any of that stuff. We're simply going to say, don't have sex, don't do it. And kids who get that as their education are actually more likely to engage in sexual activity at an earlier age and more likely to get pregnant when they do it or get sexually transmitted diseases. In fact, 10 leading scientists in the field of adolescent sexual and reproductive health today wrote a letter to Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. This wasn't today, it was last week. The news on it came out today. And this letter said, by design, abstinence programs restrict information about condoms and contraception, information that may be critical to protecting the health of young people and to preventing unplanned pregnancies, HIV infection, and infection with other sexually transmitted organisms. They ignore the health needs of sexually active youth and youth who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, and questioning for counseling, health care services, and risk reduction education. Withholding life-saving information from young people is contrary to the standards of medical ethics and to many international human rights conventions. And frankly, I couldn't have said it better myself. Stephen in Danville, California. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, the big question that I think we really need to ask on this discussion about when does life begin is, if you buy the idea that our souls are immortal and our bodies are mortal, which are we? And I think there's a great deal of opinion about the idea that the soul actually enters the body at the time of birth when it takes its first breath.
Well, that's the biblical context. I mean, you know, and in fact, it began. God breathed life into clay, and it became alive. It became the person. And
right.
And many religions around the world believe
right.
that a baby is alive when it takes its first breath.
But by taking it today, if you buy
and
the
in
idea,
fact, spirit. The word spirit comes from the Greek word for the word breath.
Yeah.
And thus inspiration and inspire and there are several variations of spire that have to do with breathing.
Well, but the big question is, do we identify with that part of us which is immortal, which is our soul, if you buy that idea, or do we identify with the body that's mortal?
Right.
And
or do you identify with intelligence? Let's set aside soul for a moment and just look at it in a purely secular context, which is really how government should be looking at it.
Well,
and that is, at what point is somebody a functional human being? And now I realize that that question carried to his extreme might suggest that a person who... and has in some societies. It did in the United States in the 1920s and the 1930s. It did in Germany in the 30s as well. They used our euthanasia posters for their purposes, suggesting that a human being who is so disabled that they're not capable of communication or not capable of what we would call normal human interaction may not be a human being. And that's a horrible road to go down.
Well, that was part of the whole eugenics movement that Lindbergh was involved with.
Yep, among others.
Which led to all of that. But getting back to the spiritual component of this, I'm a deist and a Unitarian, and I don't particularly identify as a Christian, but I tend, my view, and I'm not about to impose this on anybody else, is that what we really are is our soul. And this argument about, life begins at conception, that is only the life of the body. And those are people who identify with the body and kind of forget that what your real nature is your immortal soul.
Yeah, so now we get into the argument over the debate or the question, I guess, the spiritual, intellectual, rhetorical question of when did the soul begin? Were all the souls created upon the creation of the universe, in which case there's no point where it begins and ends? Or are souls being created all the time, every time a baby is born? And I mean, this is, it's like asking somebody who's into creation theory, and they say, well, obviously everything in the universe is made by somebody who's intelligent because, look at how cool it is. And then you say, okay, who made the being that made everything intelligent?
Well,
it's at a certain point, you know, you have to go to Deus ad Machina. You have to say, well, no, there was some magical beginning or something. If you're going to follow that kind of logic, I mean, it short circuits itself.
Well, if you look at the Hindu religion, they clearly believe in reincarnation and that souls are old and not created every
right.
time a body is born.
And so do Buddhists.
And if you read Bart Ehrman, who's done a lot of work on this, he's got a wonderful book called Misquoting Jesus that goes back to a lot of the early teachings, much of which was thrown out by the church in power, which was the Catholic Church, as being heretical.
Right. There are a number of things that Jesus said that could be interpreted as endorsing reincarnation. I mean, that's the point I'm assuming that you're making, Stephen.
Right. And one of the most pure things that I think we can get out of the old Gospels is the Gospel of Thomas, which is not part of the Bible.
Right.
It's pretty much a list of Jesus said this, Jesus said this, Jesus said this.
Right. And it's been authenticated as being at least as ancient and as solid as the Quella document, which is used as the referential basis for at least Matthew and Mark, as I recall, Matthew and Mark in any case.
Right.
I think Mark is mostly based on the Quella document. But Stephen, we've wandered into the area of theology. I'm gonna let some other folks get in on this, but I appreciate the call. Tony in Michigan. Hey, Tony.
Hi, Tom. I'm very pleased to speak with you. You're a credit to the state of Michigan. Anyway, my position is that when you boil this down, it's a power grab. It's using sex and fear of sex to maintain power. If you carry the argument of some of the people that advocate the position of birth control and not using condoms and not using other types of logical things for birth control, it boils down to the only time that sexual intercourse should take place is between a man and a woman who are married and for the purpose of conceiving a child. That's it. No
right.
other.
Which is the position of some religious folks. And you know, here's my position on all this, Tony, is I don't care what anybody thinks or even what I think about this. If it falls into the realm of religion, it should not be made into law. Our laws are based on moral code. They're based on basic human code. I mean, Thomas Jefferson pointed out in his letters to Ben Rush where he says the clergy was ever a part of this fraud. He points out that the British government, you know, people say, well, British common law is based on the Bible. It's based on the Ten Commandments. He points out that British common law started during the Heptarchy, during the 500s. And British didn't become Christian until the 700 or 800s. There was at least a 200-year period when British was not Christian, when what we call now the United Kingdom was not Christian. And that's where British civil law originated. Every culture in the world bars murder. Every culture in the world bars theft, you know, which are basically the two of the Ten Commandments that you find made into law in most nations. And many cultures bar things like, having relationships outside of marriage and things like that. I mean, whether they bar it at law or whether they bar it socially. And that's about it. I mean, you know, there's not a very many cultures that say that you can put somebody to death if a child to death if he talks back to his parents, which is one of the Ten Commandments. So, for example. So I just say, you know, if it's coming out of your religion, that's great. I honor that and I respect it. Just don't put it into my laws. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Okay, here's another song down memory lane with GW, that's me, and the Carlisle Group. Here we go. They are saying that I knew.
Well, you did, George.
That I lied to you.
Of course, George, you knew that. Oh.
Hiding, smoking guns. We blow smoke in your eyes. But that's cause you get news from your TV and they cover. smoke in your eyes. Here, Daddy, you take one. Okay, Junior.
Yeah, thanks, Daddy. It's Bush Senior.
Junior, you do what we tell you to, because there's a lot at stake. You know what Barbara says? She says, it all depends upon our corporate friends as to how much we make. Go ahead, Junior. Yeah, and I'll do what I am told until the world's controlled.
Oh, doesn't he sing beautifully?
Continuing the lies and ignoring all your cries, and we'll blow smoke in your eyes.
Yeah, they're going to be blowing some more smoke tonight, by the way. The Republican, you call this a debate. Apparently, I've got several reports on this. I haven't confirmed it yet, or at least I haven't seen it from a source that I could say, you know, yeah, okay, these guys really have it nailed down. But apparently, the Republican candidates have already been given the questions that they're going to be asked tonight. So there won't be any of those blinded deer in headlights looks like you see during the Democratic debates every time. I don't know. We'll see. It'll be interesting to find out. I will be on an airplane for part of the debate, but I'm going to try and catch some of it this tonight. So we can talk about that tomorrow. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Just a quick reminder for the folks who are dropping by our chat room that we are reconfiguring our website at tomhartman.com. However you spell it should get you there. And to get into the chat room, if you have a saved link, it probably won't work. You have to go back to tomhartman.com and just click on the chat room button up at the top. Very easy to do. Wanda, listening on K-Talk in Los Angeles. Hey, Wanda.
Yes, hello. Tom?
Hi. You're on the air.
Oh, well, hi, Tom. To begin with, I'm an atheist, so won't get into a religious aspect of it.
Okay.
But I had an idea years ago. Excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold. Anyway, that we, the taxpayers, pay for sperm banks, and we allow young men who are willing and who want to have vasectomies on our tax dollars for now, put their sperm in the sperm banks, which there'll be many of, hopefully. And when they are of age, say 21 years old, 18, 20, when they can, if they still want their sperm and have children, then they buy it back. They pay for what it costs, and they buy their sperm. And then they...
Is this all to end unwanted pregnancies among teenagers, Wanda?
Yes. And young men as young as 13, because there are young women as young as 13 having abortions without telling their parents.
Right.
Why couldn't a young man have a vasectomy?
On the one hand, it sounds like, you know, kind of a super bizarre control freak suggestion. On the other hand, you're pointing out the hypocrisy in our society that we want to control the reproductive competence and rights and abilities and whatever.
But not control,
of women,
I'm sorry.
But not of men.
Yeah, who would wish to? I said any young men who wish to have
right.
a vasectomy, not forced upon them, certainly
yeah.
not.
Interesting hypothesis, Wanda. Very interesting. Thank you very much for the call. Chris in Michigan. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask you, have you ever had Sam Harris on your program?
I don't recall.
He is an author, and he wrote a book called Letter to a Christian Nation. The book wasn't all about stem cell research, but it did dip into it. It mentioned in that book that the 3-day-old zygote or the embryo is only a collection of 150 cells. And he put that into scale. The brain of a fruit fly is over 100,000 different cells.
Right.
That always makes me wonder why people would actually consider that a life.
Well, that's my point, is that this is a religious argument, not a political argument. And the religious say, no, it's a scientific argument. Yes, 150 cells, it would actually be an even number, an even multiple of two. It goes 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, you know, just like the binary code does. So it'd be 256 cells probably, or 128 cells. But in any case, that collection of cells is clearly has the potential to become a human being if it's left intact. I mean, about half of all pregnancies actually end up in a form of miscarriage that appears to be just a normal menstrual period. I mean, you know, it's and then of course you have miscarriages out there, but I mean, it is a very, very common thing for fertilized eggs not to effectively implant, or if they implant, not to hang on there. It's actually pretty miraculous when you think about it. Everything that has to go into us being a person, you know.
Well, that's what I was going to go. I hear religious people try to make the secular argument against abortion, that it's a life, and since that's a life, it's protected by our Constitution. My counter argument that always is this: if it is a separate life, separate from the mother, so the mother cannot choose to end it, then how is it fair to the mother to say, well, you have to take care of this separate life and take care of it for 9 months until it's born? That's like somebody come up to me and say, well, your neighbor is now an invalid. It's going to take 9 months of hard recovery while you're his neighbor. You have to take care of him.
Yeah, you're making the argument,
life,
Chris.
You can't say that you take care of by the mother.
Right. You're taking us back to the discussion of the 70s, which I think was a good and healthy discussion about at what point do we consider this legally life. And by and large, the definition in the United States right now and in most developed countries is viability. The ability of the embryo to survive, or the whatever you want to call it, to survive outside, not the embryo, the child, to survive outside the mother. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned into the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
So what's going on to our south in Cuba, or on Cuba, in that part of Cuba that we control? Welcome back to the second hour of our program, by the way, 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. There's a truly, I want to say horrific, and yet at the same time I want to say brilliant. I realize those two words don't mix very well. Clive Stafford Smith is on the line with us. He's the author of a new book, 8 o'clock Ferry to the Windward Side, the subtitle Seeking Justice in Guantanamo Bay. Clive, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
In your book, you get into a variety of things around Guantanamo, and then you take it out to this larger issue of prisons around the world. And first, let's talk about Guantanamo. What led you to write this book, and how did you get into Guantanamo, and how often? And tell us about that experience.
Well, I've been going for a long time. I've been 19 times now. Actually, I calculated, and I'm slightly horrified to learn I've stayed there for like 7 months. It's a very, very strange place, quite surreal in many ways. The title of the book, 8 o'clock Ferry, just refers to the ferry you take every day. I mean, everything seems to happen the same every day. Indeed, you know, one time I was down there for a week and they played Groundhog Day every single night on television. I began to think I was
on
Groundhog Day. But, you know, there's a real mix. I don't want to give the wrong impression. There's a bunch of young soldiers there who are trying to do a terrible job as best they can. But on the other hand, my goodness, people are out of touch with reality. I recently got accused of smuggling Speedo swimming trunks into one of my clients, which I emphatically didn't do, but the only place he could swim would be his toilet. It's just a very, very odd place, and there's a lot of horrendous things that have happened there over the years.
Yeah. I should let our listeners know you're the legal director of the UK charity Reprieve, which is at reprieve.org.uk, and you've spent over 20 years representing condemned death row inmates in the southern parts of the United States, and now you're representing some of these folks down in Guantanamo. You talk about torture at Guantanamo. Tell us about this.
Well, there certainly has been torture. There's a lot of argument about the word torture and whether it applies or not, but when Donald Rumsfeld announces publicly that the goal of their strategies is to break human beings, then it really is torture of one sort or the other. And look, I mean, some of my clients, one of my guys, for example, Binyam Mohammed, I sat across him in Guantanamo and spent 3 days talking about how he was taken by the CIA to Morocco, where they took a razor blade to his genitals, for goodness sake. And, you know, I never thought...
You mean actually cut him or threatened to cut him?
Oh, no, they cut him. They cut him. They cut him horribly. And, you know, even that wasn't the worst thing. He told me about other things they did to him. that were so humiliating that he forbade me from repeating them in public. Mm. And so, you know, I have to leave that to your imagination. But it never occurred to me, when I went to law school in New York many years ago, never occurred to me that I'd be sitting across the table from some chap talking to him about how our government, and I know despite my accent, I am American, our government has been behind this sort of torture. It's really shocking.
Yeah, indeed. And to what extent does this happen, or has this happened, in Guantanamo itself?
There's been a lot of horrendous abuses there. There still are. One of my clients is a guy called Samuel Hajj, who's an Al Jazeera journalist, and who really is no
journalist, a reporter.
Yeah, someone like you, a devious, terrible character who should clearly be locked up. I say that in jest. But
well, I mean, that's Bill O'Reilly's comment.
All those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Yeah,
he would probably like that done to you, I agree.
Yes.
But it's not something we as Americans do. Samuel Hajj really isn't a terrorist. I mean, I don't ask you to take my word for it. We just want a fair trial. But Sammy's been on hunger strike now for 330 days, with the only request being that he be given a fair trial. Every day what they do is they stick this 48-inch tube up his nose, and then in order to make it painful, and they said this, it's not me saying it, but in order to make it painful, they pull it out after each force feeding. And I've tried that, and I don't advise you to do it yourself.
Mm.
It's very painful. So these things are still going on. Now, it's not the same sort of level of systematic torture that happened in the early days of Guantanamo, thankfully. I think, you know, because that's been exposed publicly, that's not happening in the same degree.
How is it that the Bush administration has been so successful, and Republicans in Congress, and the media for that matter, in the United States, at keeping this off the radar screen of the average American? I don't think the average American has any idea what is being done in his and her name.
Well, I think you're right, and I should confess that when I first went down to visit the prisoners in Guantanamo, I thought that the majority of people I was going to meet were on the battlefield, just like Rumsfeld said, and I was going to have some explaining to do. And, you know, my principle was a matter of fair trials, not that everyone was innocent. But, you know, the more I've been down there, the more you discover that because we were offering all of these bounties around Pakistan, $5,000 for each foreigner,
that's like a lifetime's income for some people.
It's a lot of money. It would translate for us in America at about $250,000. So the issue would be, as you look around you, you know, who would you be willing to snitch on for $250,000?
Right.
And unfortunately, a large number of people were turned in just for the money. Then they were abused, and they confessed that indeed they were in, you know, Tora Bora or wherever. Then they got a one-way ticket to Guantanamo, and they were locked up there. The number of innocent people is astounding down there, it really is. But I don't think most people would think off the bat that the Bush administration would have made that many mistakes. Perhaps we're beginning to figure it out now, but even I didn't. I went down thinking most people would be guilty.
But how is it that we don't know this? I mean, it's like the media in the United States they are very reluctant, particularly the visual media, the newspapers with photos and television, very reluctant to show pictures of dead bodies, of carnage, of the consequences of our bombing, of the consequences of firefights, of dead U.S. soldiers, dead Iraqi civilians at all. You know, that whole thing. And although CNN International will show those pictures, CNN Domestic won't. I mean, what is this a cultural phenomenon that we don't want to know about it? Is there some sort of a media blackout? I mean, what's going on here?
There is perhaps there's some of that, but you know, a bigger part of it in Guantanamo is purely the censorship. Much as the military pretends that it's a very transparent and open prison, it's not. Every single word my clients say to me has to go through the censors, and I can't repeat it if it's not been censored. And, you know, just to illustrate it, I had a little thing going at one point when we were allowed to take books down to the prisoners. I used to take a whole series of books and see what they would censor. And, you know, they censored amongst us lawyers. We took books and they censored Puss in Boots. They censored Jack and the Beanstalk. All these ridiculous things. And that, I tell that only as an illustration of the degree to which the truth gets censored in Guantanamo.
What, they think Jack and the Beanstalk was a manual on how to climb high things to get out of
it? I assume you're going to plant a bean and somehow get over the walls. I don't know. that, you know, all of this stuff was really absurd. But it's much more insidious when my client tells me that he's been tortured and I write it down, and then it goes through the senses, and the senses tell me that I can't repeat that to you, you know, the facts of the torture, because that's a method and means of interrogation by the U.S. military. You know, that's terrible, and there's a lot of that sort of thing going on. Obviously, I can't tell you what's been censored, but there's an awful lot of that type of thing that's still being covered up in Guantanamo.
So as much as you've told us, there's much that you can't tell us, because if you did, you would end up in prison.
Well, that's true, and paradoxically, of course, if my client has told me, and this happened once, and it's now been unclassified, so I can tell you about it, but originally my client told me about two murders he saw committed by U.S. personnel in Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. He tells me about that. If I reveal that to the world, I then go to prison for 40 years. So it's some, you know, military personnel who's done the crime, and I do the time. It took us months of fighting to get that information public. And again, you know, there's a lot of those things that still haven't got public.
I'm assuming that that information has not led to the investigation or prosecution of the people who committed the murders.
Well, it did lead to an investigation, actually, and there was ultimately a prosecution of some people. But again, you know, they tend to go after the small fry. They don't tend to go after the people who established the rules for the abuse of prisoners. And, you know, I've got to say, I think any human being who's ordered to do things by senior officers is liable to go along with them. And it's really the people who established these torture memos in the White House who need to be held accountable.
Which are Gonzalez and Rumsfeld in this case.
Exactly.
Yeah. Clive Stafford Smith is the author. The book, 8 O'Clock Ferry to the Windward Side. A brilliant piece of journalism. Clive, thank you so much for dropping by.
Thank you.
And also, let me just plug your website, reprieve.org.uk as well. 8 O'Clock Ferry to the Windward Side. Check it out. 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Even if your hands are shaking and your faith is broken, even as the eyes are closing, do it with a heart wide.
And welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. Where are we going with this thing? I mean, this is absolutely, you hear these stories about what's going on in Guantanamo, how we're outsourcing torture, how Alberto Gonzalez, George Bush, Dick Cheney, and Don Rumsfeld, among others, Doug Fife and others in this administration, and their whole Republican, and a few Democrats, and even an independent, Joe Lieberman, how their chorus are just skipping along home free as human beings are being tortured and frankly killed in our name, in your name and my name. I mean, it's like, it's, at a certain point, it's just like, you know, how terrible does this get? And then you look at things like House Resolution 1955, Senate Resolution 1959, this Prevention of Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Act. Guantanamo soon to come to a living room near you? Now, I remember when I first encountered this, and we're going to do an entire hour on this tomorrow. We're going to get an expert on here and an attorney and really drill into it. But broadly speaking, I remember when I first encountered this was just a few months ago. I was down, and I talked about it on the air at the time, only albeit briefly. I was down receiving the Project Censored Award in Modesto, California, and several of the folks there that I was on the panel with, and one of them I was on a panel with is going to be our guest tomorrow, and we're all, you know, everybody was buzzing about this thing. It has recently passed the House of Representatives. Only 6 members of the House voted against it, and everybody was all upset about it. I thought, I've got to read this thing. And somebody was able to actually hand me a printout while I was there, and I just sat down and I read the entire bill. And after the first time I read through it, my response was, my thought on it was, this isn't such a big deal. This is just creating a commission to look into things. And really, it's kind of presenting it like, let's figure out why Tim McVeigh did what he did. Because that's homegrown terrorism. Why would an American seek to destroy the United States? Let's figure this out. And maybe we'll find out something about ourselves. Maybe we'll find out something about our culture. Maybe we'll learn something that would be really useful. And I went back and read it again and saw that, frankly, I think probably one of the most insidious parts of this entire thing is the very beginning, Section 899A, definitions, where they redefine terms, essentially. For the purposes of this subtitle, violent radicalization means the process of adopting or promoting an extremist belief system. Say what? For the purpose of facilitating ideologically based violence to advance political, religious, or social change. Okay, well, a belief system for the purpose of violence, so it's about thinking crimes? Homegrown terrorism means the use, planned use, or threatened use of force or violence by a group of individuals born, raised, or based and primarily operating within the United States or any possession of the U.S. to intimidate or coerce the United States government, the civilian population of the United States, or any segment thereof in furtherance of political or social objectives. Ideologically based violence, what does that mean? The term ideologically based violence means the use, planned use, or threatened use of force or violence by a group or individual to promote the group or individual's political, religious, or social beliefs. Now, you could argue that, well, of course we should, you know, Congress should set up a commission to study this kind of stuff. If this is going to happen here, and it certainly did with Tim McVeigh back during the Clinton administration, and arguably it has happened at other times in our history. If this is going to happen here in the United States, we should know about it. The problem is that this is establishing a precedent. This is redefining our terms. This is taking us closer and closer to the thought crimes area. And actually, frankly, the thing that concerns me about the most about this is that we have already seen in the last Republican Congress the passage of the Military Commissions Act, which creates a complete third parallel form of court system. We have the military court system, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and we have the civilian court system in the United States. We now have a third court system that was created specifically by the Military Commissions Act. This military commissions system that's essentially a kangaroo court. And that kangaroo court is there to deal with terrorists. So if the executive branch of the military or the executive branch says, this person is a terrorist, they then fall into this third branch of government, which where you don't have habeas corpus and you don't have the rights guaranteed in the Constitution. And now this piece of legislation, it seems, is setting up that... Okay, now let's define who is going to be under the jurisdiction of that third branch of government. People who are believing something that may cause them to think about something. Not wise. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Tomorrow night, 7:30, Santa Monica. I'll be at the Barnes & Noble on the 3rd Street Promenade. Drop by, hear a riff, get a book signed if you'd like for my new book, Cracking the Code. Friday night, I'll be at Oak Park, California's Ventura County Democrat Speaker Series, 7 to 9 p.m., 1000 Cannon Road in Oak Park, California. And on December 14th, coming up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, we'll be at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at the Kauffman Memorial Union. Well, we went to CNN.com. I went to CNN.com just now. David pointed this out to me. David Poole, my producer, he says, boy, big news over there. This is the stuff that we really need to know as American citizens. This is the stuff that's critical to democracy. I mean, it's really important news. O.J. Simpson pleads not guilty to 12 felony charges. Right up at the top of the page. Aren't you pleased to know that we are being kept up to the moment on the most important and vital issues of our day? Well, I am. Yeah, right. Okay, the Violent Radicalization Homegrown Terrorism Act. This passed the House of Representatives. It has not yet passed the Senate. It has been introduced into the Senate as Senate Bill 1959. It's 1955 in the House. Only six people voted against it. Dana Rohrabacher, the Republican from California. Jeff Flake, the Republican from Arizona. John Duncan, the Republican from Tennessee. Jerry Costello, the Democrat from Illinois. Neil Abercrombie, the Democrat from Hawaii. And Dennis Kucinich, the Democrat from Ohio. They are the only ones who voted against this in the House of Representatives. Period. The vote 404-6. And there were 22 people who didn't bother to vote. So, anyhow, it's something that frankly concerns me. As I said, we are going to get into this in considerable depth tomorrow. So we will be circling back around on this topic. But just this whole broad issue of how free are we? Particularly when we discover that the people who are supposed to be watching the agencies that are watching us, keep in mind, the purpose of the Constitution was not to grant us freedoms. We are granted no freedoms at all in the Constitution, because the Constitution begins with that three magic words, we the people. What the Constitution does is it begins with the premise that all powers and all freedoms are resident with we the people. And we the people are, out of our own volition, voluntarily, for the public good, in order to promote the general welfare and ensure prosperity and security, etc., we collectively, we the people, are going to create a government and limit its powers. And what the Constitution is all about is limiting the powers of government. And frankly, of some other institutions in our society. Jefferson argued very strongly that one of the first ten amendments of the Constitution should be a ban on monopolies. He was unsuccessful, but he argued strongly for that. So here we have now Scott Bloch, B-L-O-C-H. He's the guy who runs the Office of Special Counsel. He's the guy in the executive agency, in the executive branch, working for George Bush. Out of the Office of Personnel and Management, he's the Inspector General for the Office of Personnel Management. He's the guy who is supposed to investigate whether or not Karl Rove broke the law by deleting computer files, right? You know, all the missing Republican emails, 5 million missing Republican emails, which would probably, in my opinion, frankly, would reveal many high crimes and misdemeanors. Turns out this guy who is supposed to be looking into whether or not Karl Rove was deleting files, this guy called Geeks on Call to come out and delete files from his computer. Today's Wall Street Journal, John Wilkie, the head of the federal agency investigating Karl Rove's White House political operation, is facing allegations that he improperly deleted computer files during another probe using a private computer help company, Geeks on Call. It's great publicity for the Geeks on Call, I guess. Scott Bloch runs the Office of Special Counsel, an agency charged with protecting government whistleblowers and enforcing a ban on federal employees engaging in partisan political activity. This would be the guy who's supposed to make sure that Rove isn't doing PowerPoint demonstrations, presentations for people within the executive branch that encourage them to help out Republicans. Mr. Bloch's agency is, that's my language, now back to the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Bloch's agency is looking into whether Mr. Rove and other White House officials used government agencies to help reelect Republicans in 2006. At the same time, Mr. Bloch himself has been under investigation since 2005. Whether he retaliated against employees and dismissed whistleblower cases. So now it turns out he called the 1-800 number for Geeks on Call And they sent out a technician in one of their signature PT Cruiser wagons and did a little deleting on his computer. Very strange. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jane in Seattle. Hey, Jane, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I am calling in reference to your prior guest you just had on.
Yeah.
And I was right in the middle of reading Shock Doctrine, and I tuned in. And there is a website that people can go to check on the status of Sammy Hodge. It's prisoner345.net/Sammy, SAMI-HAJ.
Okay, prisoner.
And you can check. He's been in Guantanamo 1,994 days, 10 hours, 39 minutes, and 55 seconds.
Wow. Prisoner345.net is
the website about Sammy Hodge, and you can send support messages and read his letters. Prisoner345.net/Sammy, SAMI-HAJ.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, Jane. I appreciate it. Brian in Everett, Washington. Hey, Brian.
Violent radicalization?
Yeah.
Does that mean I have to get out off the couch?
No, actually, it means you have to think off the couch.
I have to formulate an ideology that thinks that I might want to, formulating violent ideologies is a big business that happens en masse.
Yeah.
They don't want anyone, they have a monopoly on that. They don't want anyone coming up with their own thing.
Hey, you want violent ideology? Here, listen to this.
You got to kill the terrorists before the killing stops. And I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
That's Jerry
Palmer. In the name of the Lord.
Yeah, he out of the way before they could get him.
You don't see Jesus being real violent. Now, there's other parts in the Bible where if you want to talk about Revelation when he comes back, which is a difficult book to groove on.
Yeah, it's pretty.
You
cool.
know, it's like you think. Well, Jesus is going to come back. Well, he was mad about what happened last time, so he's going to shut down this system that he oppressed him so much. And that's kind of how I see it. But what are you going to do? You know, everyone's got a lot of religions and armies all have violent ideology. I think they just don't want any independent thinking.
Yeah, no, good point, Brian. And thanks a lot for the call. Debbie in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Debbie.
Hey, Tom. What's this leave us with? Are we not allowed to call our congressmen and senators because they just want to collect their $170,000 a year and not be bothered?
You know, I have a hard time. Here's the problem with this. This is the whole slippery slope thing. I have a hard time thinking that Jane Harman or any of the Democrats, or frankly even most of the Republicans who supported House Resolution 1955, thought that they were sending us down a road that would lead to the thought police. It is so un-American. It is so blatantly un-American that most of them would say, nah, you know, if that's how it was presented to them. And it really, you know, you read, as I said, if you actually read the legislation, it seems fairly benign, but it's not. Go ahead, Debbie. You were going to say something.
I said maybe they should read it.
Yeah, well,
there's been a lot of stuff they haven't read.
Maybe, well, that's the big problem is they're reading summaries, they're hearing these things. And Debbie, thanks for the call. Or they're having their staff read it, and somebody on the staff is freshly out of college or whatever. I mean, it's just as I said, we're gonna dig into this at some length. Kent in Manhattan, hey Kent.
Yeah,
Kent?
Tom,
you're on the air.
You're wrong.
Okay.
About this. They're doing one of two things. They're either sending us a signal, like Khrushchev did to Kennedy, like a little red flag help. This is absolutely ridiculous, Bill. I read the first thing. Any man that's read Orwell or a woman that's read Orwell, it's right there in black and white, written by a Democrat that would never create something like that.
Right, so here's the question. Why did Jane Harman do this?
If they want to know why... We're getting, they're worried about violent radicalizations because we're calling them because they're not doing their job. They're breaking their contract with us, and it's our job to rise up with people and do something about it. We're calling them, and they're taking it as threats, and they're getting scared, and they ought to.
All right. Well, and the rise up is going to have to be at the ballot box. It ain't going to work any other way. You've never tried to take on a Black Hawk helicopter. Dennis in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Dennis.
Hey, listen. This is what we conservatives can't stand about the loony left. I mean, they're welcome to in my name. These people are sworn Al-Qaeda people. They're sworn to kill the infidels. And I don't mind.
Dennis, apparently you didn't listen to our guest. We're talking about if somebody was paid $250,000 of $250,000 bounty and turned you in to, say, the government of Egypt, and the government of Egypt had decided to torture you, how'd you feel about that?
Yeah, but you guys are against Guantanamo Bay. I mean, we're trying to disseminate information from these guys that might save thousands.
What I'm, Dennis, I'm sorry, you've been watching too much TV. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
GW, that's me and the Carlisle Group. Here we go, get real close. Strangers in the night, exchanging gunfire, liberals so uptight, call me a liar. Challenging my war before my term is through. Something in their eyes is getting scary. Keeping to my plan is getting hairy. Every day it's hard to do the things I do.
Oh, George.
Justify my fight. Please, Limbaugh, Hannity, O'Reilly on the right. Keep my agenda on the burners burning bright. Because I'm so uptight. Demonize the left today and take their right to speak away. And if you all succeed, we'll satisfy your hunger and your greed with all the corporate dollars that you need and some pretty little strangers in the night.
Oh, thank you so much, George, you know, yes. 51 minutes past the hour. Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. on the line, talkradionews.com. Hey, Alan.
Lots going on, of course, most of it going around this Mideast peace process, plus there's a few other little items the White House is engaged in today. But it looks as if the president is not going to go have Condoleezza Rice directly involved in this, but indirectly, he is looks like he's appointing James L. Jones, a former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO forces, and he is going to be meeting and making sure that these talks happen. They're going to begin December 12th, and about every other week it looks as if the Israelis and Palestinians will be meeting.
Yeah. And it looks like Olmert and Abbas have actually developed a good personal relationship over the year, independent of anything that the Bush administration has done, long before it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, Olmert has had him over to his home where they sit and talk privately and, you know, no guards, no note takers, nothing, just the two of them sitting in his study. I'm curious, Ellen, if you saw the coverage last night, or if you were there, or if you saw the coverage that was that PBS aired last night on the McNeil Lehrer or the McNeil Report or whatever it's called these days, of the Annapolis conference.
Well, actually, I had two people there. I was in Mississippi, unfortunately, but we were doing pool that day, so Lavista was one of the people that was actually in the room at the time.
Great. Well, here's a question I'd like you to toss out to that person and get back with us on it. I was watching the TV coverage, and here you've got a room that is now they have gone to great lengths to get a whole bunch of very conservative Muslim men into this room, right? And
Lavista described it as tiny.
Yeah, well, and not only that, there was one point where the camera panned across the audience. Now, Abbas was up speaking from the podium, and they panned across the audience, and in the front row of the audience, there's all these men, in the front row of the audience is Condoleezza Rice. And she is wearing a short skirt, and she's got her legs crossed in a way that from that camera angle, it was flashing nearly to her panties. And I'm thinking, this is making me sound like some kind of anti-feminist or something, but if you're trying to pull these people together and you're going to be the broker, it just seemed counterintuitive that you would dress in a way that you know is going to insult or offend them. And it startled me. And I would be very interested to know what the take was of one of your people who was actually there about the way that Condi was dressing and sitting.
I can ask Lavisa. Unfortunately, when they went into the room, they were on the sides, and so they actually couldn't. They did not have a front of Condoleezza. The cameras actually had a much better view.
Well, the camera angle was incredible. I mean, I paused that last night and said, Louise, you got to come here and look at this. And she looked at it and she said, that can't be real. And I'm like, no, this is Condi Rice flashing these guys.
I'll get Lavisa's take on it. And actually, I had somebody else there, but they weren't in the room. They were with the other delegation. But I'll get her take on, and if she heard anything about it, because I know she was in the press van, and she was in the helicopter.
Right. And you say now she's not going to be involved. I'm wondering if that, you know, at some level that she, you know, created a stir or offended them, you know, with her fashion statement. I was just astounded, and again,
it's interesting because I do know that when some of the female senators have gone to Saudi Arabia, they haven't necessarily dressed in the full abaya, but they have worn headscarves and dressed very conservatively. I mean,
right,
when
I was in Saudi Arabia,
I dressed in the full abaya with a headscarf, and you know, I'm so fat, I was happy to have the black to cover me up.
Oh, you're not, Helen. You're not. But the point is, I mean, you know, if you're gonna, I mean, Madeleine Albright at least, you know, would not have been showing her legs, certainly not above the knee, and Condi was showing more than half of that, and you know, there's a time and place for that. It's a fine thing, but when you're trying to get a bunch of conservative, you know, Muslim Arab men together to do something, maybe she thought it would work for her. I have a feeling that it would work against her. Anyhow, we just have a minute here.
Okay, I just wanted to add two real quick things. Representative Hostetler, who is no longer a representative, he was representative Republican, and he now actually he was one of the six people to vote against the war. He has a book coming out called Nothing for the Nation. And he said that he's going to detail the hidden political motives behind the Iraq war. That book will be coming out in December. And last but not least...
Which party is he with?
Republican.
Uh-huh.
He was one of the six Republicans to vote against the war.
Okay.
And also, I don't know if you've been following the issue with Scott Block from the Office of Special Counsel, who called Geeks on Call to clean his computer rather than using the IT team associated with his organization.
Right. And this, you know, another Republican, more missing Republican emails, more missing Republican information. And he's the guy who's supposed to be investigating Karl Rove?
Exactly.
Very bizarre.
Geeks on Call.
There you go. Yeah, I think the guy's committed a crime. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com, the website Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you today. Stick around. Coming up next, Scott Dicker with The Onion, of all things.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you know what you don't know, sometimes you don't know what you do know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes...
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be, as the Fireside Theater reminds us. Scott Dicker is with us. He is the editor-in-chief of The Onion, theonion.com. And Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you.
You guys have a new book out, Our Dumb World?
We sure do.
Tell us about this.
Our Dumb World is an atlas of the planet Earth, as created by The Onion. We grew up loving atlases and loving those books about maps and stuff, but I'm sure you've looked at some of those. They're boring. There really is not that much in there to get excited about. And also, it seemed like now in this very politicized climate that we live in, a lot of our leaders are using I don't know where they're getting their information about what's going on in the world and how they're basing their decisions on foreign policy. I mean, maybe the Competitive Enterprise Institute or the Bible, and we figured, why not The Onion?
Right.
Let's create a book that Dick Cheney can look at and say, oh, that looks like a great country to invade. will invade that country, Angola, for example.
Angola?
And we lay out the instructions for how to take over some of these more vulnerable countries.
Now, and you know, oddly, I mean, Angola is the country that Dag Hammarskjöld was flying into to negotiate peace in 61, I think, the year that his plane went down and he died?
I actually know that from researching this book, if you can believe that.
Oh, that's interesting. I remember when it happened. He was one of my
heroes.
That's
impressive. Well, I was
a little kid. I think I was in 61. I would have been what, nine years old or 10 years old. So
you followed current events even then.
I guess I remember Dag Hammarskjöld. He was just absolutely the coolest guy in the world, and the Secretary General of the United Nations.
Yes.
The second Secretary General of the United Nations in its history. And so you think that Angola is a good country for Cheney to invade? Why?
Well, I mean, basically any country in Africa is ripe for the picking at this point. If you're going to go for, if you like a coastal country, you can go for Angola, but there might be a few too many landmines.
Nice beaches there, too many landmines, okay.
Right, but I mean, a nice beach for Dick Cheney means, you know, think of how many oil drilling apparatus you could set up there.
That's true.
And there's a lot of untapped resources in Africa that are just waiting to be stolen.
Yeah, well, ironically, again, I keep bringing the serious into this, but I mean, the Chinese are scouring Africa right now. There's the interesting piece in the Financial Times a couple of weeks ago about how they're wheeling and dealing, making deals all over Africa to start, quote, exploiting natural resources, end quote.
Right, they're besting us in places like Nigeria.
Yeah, they're better colonialists than the professional colonialists.
We're old hats, but they're getting good.
Yeah. So other stories in the Our Dumb World.
We lay out every country on the planet and mm-hmm. provide a little summary of the nation, a little information about it, some factoids. And in the time-honored onion tradition, every country sort of has a header, like a little headline for it, so you really understand the country in just a couple of words. Ukraine, for example, is the breadbasket of Europe.
It actually is.
Yes. It's where, a lot of websites like UkrainianBrides.com are based in the Ukraine.
Yeah, it's a major mail-order bride business operating out of the Ukraine. Yeah.
And then Afghanistan, Allah's Cat Box.
Ooh.
Where we have a lot of really
As in Kitty Litter Box, you mean?
What's that?
As in Kitty Litter Box?
Yes.
Oy.
We follow up with that famous photograph from National Geographic, that woman on the cover that sort of captivated the nation's attention. Where is she today? A little information about Osama bin Laden. And
for example, what do you tell us about Osama bin Laden?
Well, it says here that in a show of tough love, bin Laden family friend and U.S. President George Bush exacted the harshest punishment he could think of for Osama bin Laden's attack on September 11th, and that was forcing bin Laden to live with the guilt of knowing that what he had done was wrong.
It was a tough one. It was a tough one.
He's hard on the terrorists.
Yeah, so fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. Scott Dicker, he is the editor-in-chief of The Onion. The new Atlas is out, Our Dumb World. Scott, thanks a lot for dropping by and sharing with us your thoughts on what's happening in the world and Our Dumb World.
Sure. It's my my pleasure to misinform your listeners.
There you go. Okay. Thanks a lot, Scott. Have a good one. Oh, my. 11 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Bill O'Reilly is declaring victory on the war on Christmas. Yes. I'm telling you, it's a war on Hanukkah. That's what's going on. And the problem is, you know, he's doing comedy. I mean, here we go, from The Onion to Bill O'Reilly. And doesn't even realize it, and we're anyway. This Bill O'Reilly, also in Fort Collins, Colorado, the Anti-Christmas Task Force, which recommended banning traditional decorations on public property, has been rebuffed. The folks said, "No, it's a great victory." Oh, gee, so we should have our tax dollars paying for religious things, religious icons. So let's see, which religions shall we pick to have our tax dollars paid for? How about the animists? How about fill in the blanks. It could get very strange, as it inevitably it will. Joe Lieberman is telling us about how wonderful our success in Iraq is. which reminds us of some wonderful quotes in the past. John McCain, for example, on the 5th of November 2003, "Let there be no doubt, victory can only be our only exit strategy. We are winning in Iraq." On December 14th of that year, he said, "This is mission accomplished." Joe Lieberman, in November of 2005, "I can report real progress there. Progress is visible and practical." And December of 2005, "I believe this point may be seen as a turning point in the war in Iraq." Yeah. Sad stuff. Sad stuff. So $250,000, this is the magic number the Center for American Progress is pointing out over at thinkprogress.org. The amount that it has cost the RNC to recover missing emails sent by Karl Rove and other White House aides. House investigators have charged the RNC with overseeing the extensive destruction of those emails, which may have violated the Presidential Records Act. $250,000 has gone to former FBI agents hired to retrieve the lost emails and to lawyers hired to defend the RNC. Now, this suggests to me that maybe they haven't even been retrieving these things. They are simply paying lawyers. I don't know. We'll see. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, a lot on the table today. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hi. First, about the block and the Rove investigator and his wiping of his hard drive.
Yeah.
His argument about the virus can be blown out of the water instantly because he did a level 7 wipe, seven-level wipe. You don't do that for a virus. You don't need to wipe a hard disk that deeply to get rid of a virus.
What's a level 7 wipe?
When you are wiping a hard drive, you rewrite it with zeros and ones or with zeros.
Right.
And you can do it multiple times. So you can do it just...
forensically, it's impossible to go back and find out what used to be there.
Yes. Well, see, if you're getting rid of a virus, you want to get rid of usable... Yeah, the virus, if you do a single wipe, you're going to be getting rid of usable data.
Which is where the virus would reside.
They're doing a deeper level wipe, which gets rid of detectable data, but not usable data. You get rid of usable data on the first wipe.
Right, so it's pretty obvious that this guy was covering stuff up.
Absolutely. It's just cut and dried.
Yeah.
Anyway, about the homegrown terrorism, as usual, Kucinich is the one who stands up for us.
Right, only one of six people in the House of Representatives.
The one thing we really need to look at is, see, they conveniently use the word violence, but they also use the word force. And when you talk about tomorrow, we need to define what is force. Because, like, is a boycott, is that force? If you look at ETA, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act.
Right. That's actually the hook for our conversation tomorrow. We're going to have Odette Wilkins on, and she's a lawyer and expert on this.
Yeah, because in this case, just economic harm is considered something. I mean, the Shack 7 has been convicted. Six of the Shack 7 have been convicted. I guess you'll talk about it tomorrow. But the question is, would Gandhi, King, Rosa Parks, would they be terrorists? Because they used force, not violence, but force. So Gandhi, with assault.
Well, Gandhi certainly would have been convicted because he was using economic force. Well, there was the Montgomery bus boycott. Arguably, that was economic force against government.
Rosa Parks wouldn't move.
Yeah.
That force.
Yeah. Although, see, that didn't cost anybody any money, but the bus boycott did.
Yes, but the Homegrown Terrorism Act doesn't say economics, it says force.
Well, I was thinking of the Enterprise Terrorism Act says that if it costs somebody some money, then you're out. But, yeah, we will be talking about that at some depth tomorrow. Thanks a lot, Jeff, for the call. Much appreciated. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Oh, everyone believes your emptiness, everything. Oh, everyone believes no one's going quiet. We're never gonna win the world. We're never gonna stop the world.
21 minutes past the hour. Larry Scott on the line with us with VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to do it. Hey, Larry.
And we're doing just that, Tom.
And you're doing a fine job of it. I see this quote up at the top of your website, VAWatchdog.org, a quote from Anthony J. Principi, the former Republican Secretary of Veterans Affairs.
Yes.
"History is littered with governments destabilized by masses of veterans who believe that they had been taken for fools by a society that grew rich and fat at the expense of their hardship and suffering." It kind of reminds me of the Bonus Army, but what's a Republican doing saying that?
Yeah, he,
Anthony Principe was kind of a wild card. He was a lifelong Republican, very true and loyal to the party, but he had this pro-veteran streak in there. He would do what he was told, like in 2003 when he cut off a whole group of veterans from enrolling. But when you turned him loose, he would say things like this, and you would get a deeper look into the man, and he had a real love of veterans and a commitment to veterans. And it's kind of interesting. He lost his job when he complained about $1 billion missing out of the VA budget. In 2004, he had just given an interview to his hometown paper in San Diego about the next 4 years of, you know, of his tenure as VA secretary, and everything was rolling along fine. Then he gave an interview that said, we need another $1.2 billion. Where is this money? Boom, he's gone, just like that. He was literally, although he quit for personal reasons, resigned for personal reasons, he was literally forced out by the White House because he complained about not enough funds in the VA budget.
He was too much of an advocate for Veterans Affairs.
I can't have that. Can't have that.
Yeah. So speaking of Veterans Affairs, and feel free to recalibrate this if there's a story that you think is more important or that you want to get to right away. But this whole enlistment bonus recruitment thing, we gave you money to sign up, and then you got blown up and you can't serve, so we want the money back?
This has been really, making the rounds for the last week, Tom. What this is not the story it appears. This is an important story, but what this is a bureaucratic snafu. The Pentagon policy, Department of Defense policy, is if you are unable, through no fault of your own, to complete your commitment, you do not have to pay back an enlistment or a reenlistment bonus. So that would include illness, injury, being wounded, or so forth. Somewhere deep in the bureaucracy, persons unknown or computers unknown, we haven't quite figured this one out yet, started sending out these letters to people who'd been wounded or injured in action saying, they medically discharged them, and they say, you've got to give the bonus back. That is not the policy. 2 days ago, Department of Defense said, wait a minute, this is not our policy. This is an error. We will correct it. These people will not have to repay their bonuses. But it sure has been a heck of a news banker. As a matter of fact, it's the only time I ever heard Randy Rhodes and Glenn Beck give exactly the same rant.
Yeah, well, and here too, and although I have to say, at the time I said I can't believe that they're actually doing this. I mean, this is just too stupid, even for Republicans.
Right. Well, it was stupid, but it comes under the heading of bureaucratic error, bureaucratic nightmare that has not been sorted out yet. But it was done in error, and the DOD has said, we are not doing this, we are not going to do it. These people do not have to pay back their reenlistment money. And, of course, that's the best thing of all, to know that there is a policy in place that allows these people to keep their bonus if they are injured or wounded in the line of duty.
Yeah, well, that's reassuring. I'm curious your take on whether this bureaucratic snafu might be a result of the cutbacks in the VA budget that have actually, the Bushies, like Katrina is the classic example. They're so famous for damaging government, and then when government doesn't work the way it's supposed to, saying, see, I told you so, government isn't any good. Or might it be somebody inside the VA did this as a way of essentially sabotaging the administration to draw attention to the crises at the VA?
Both of those theories are very interesting. I really don't have word on either of those, although I really don't think this would have been done from the VA because these bonuses were being paid by the individual services. So we're going up to the Pentagon level, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, and so forth. So this would have had to have happened somewhere inside the Pentagon itself or inside the Department of Defense. Whether it was done, someone just said, well, let's overlook this and try to recoup some money, I can't tell you. My personal feeling is it was just a bureaucratic error, persons and or computers that weren't doing their job correctly.
Was 20,000 vets with brain injuries not being listed in the tally, the Pentagon tally, a screw-up?
That wasn't a screw-up at all. What that is what the Pentagon does. The Pentagon claims there are a little over 4,000 troops that have traumatic brain injury. All they are counting, basically the ones that they can identify directly in combat, mainly what we call open head wounds, where it's obvious a person, a piece of the skull is gone. They say, okay, that's a traumatic brain injury. But now Department of Defense requires all people coming out of the combat theater to be screened for traumatic brain injuries. These screenings done overseas and stateside have turned up 20,000 more troops with traumatic brain injuries, but for some reason the Department of Defense has decided not to add that to the figure. So that figure would actually be closer to 25,000 instead of the 4,400 they say right now.
Yeah, is that going to change? Are they going to add them?
I don't know, but, you know, no news is good news as far as the Pentagon's concerned.
There you go, yeah, as far as the Bushies, for sure.
Yeah.
Larry Scott with VAWatchdog.org, a great site. Larry, thanks so much for
Thank you so know, much, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, Governor Bill Richardson. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Governor Bill Richardson on the line with us. Richardson4President.com is website. Governor, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Tom. Nice to be with you.
Glad to have you with us. How is the campaign going?
It's going well. We're moving up in Iowa and New Hampshire, which, as you know, are the crucial states. We're tied with Senator Edwards statistically in New Hampshire. In Iowa, we're fourth, but we're in the teens with a few moving up, with only a few, maybe 8 points separating us from the leader that varies from Clinton and Obama. And I feel we have momentum. You know, the last minute TV, my intensive campaigning, it's working, and voters in those two states like underdogs. They like to shake things up, so I'm hopeful, and I'm just trying to end up in the top three in both Iowa and New Hampshire. So I feel that this is a surge that is going to work.
What do you feel are the things that significantly differentiate you from your competitors in this race? I mean, right across the board, from the major competitors to the minor ones in the Democratic side. And then I want to ask what you feel are the things that differentiate you from potential Republican competitors should you be the nominee of the party?
Well, first, on the Democratic side, I'm the only governor, the only CEO, somebody that's run a state, balanced a budget, created jobs, improved health care, and no one has the same executive experience. Secondly, foreign policy experience. I've been a special envoy with countries like North Korea. I've been UN ambassador. I've been in the House Intelligence Committee. I've been Secretary of Energy in the President's Cabinet. I know how to make energy independent, the country energy independent. And then lastly, I've had legislative experience. I was 15 years in the Congress. But most importantly, apart from the resume, is I've been able to change things, bring people together, get ceasefires among countries, to rescue American hostages and servicemen, and govern in a way that gets things done. I think that's a big difference between me and the Democratic candidates.
It is a significant, and I mean, you can really get your hands around that. It's just a solid resume that you have, and you have truly done some extraordinary things in your life. You're putting forward proposals to, for example, cut oil demand 50% by 2020, reduce greenhouse gas emissions 90% by 2050. This has to be making huge enemies in the oil lobby.
Well, in the oil lobby and in the auto lobby, and they're going to fight it tooth and nail if I become president, but I just believe the American people are ready to be inspired to bring, they want somebody who can bring the country together. And, you know, I also think, Tom, the American people are willing to sacrifice a little bit for the common good, like in being more sensitive with energy efficient appliances and fuel efficiency. And then also, in terms of national service for the country, in terms of working together to have universal health care and improve our schools. I really feel there's kind of a Kennedy-esque spirit among the American people that they're tired of politicians telling them everything's on the cheap, that we got this big debt, that we're going to have a war without it being authorized, that we're going to pile up a $9 trillion debt and make the planet dirty. I think the American people are ready for dramatic change.
Yeah, I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. Speaking of some of those issues that you raised, how would you go about producing a national health care? How would you make sure that every American has access to health care?
Well, I would establish a national policy, no matter who you are, whether you're a ditch digger or a teacher, black, brown, that everyone's entitled to the best possible health care. What I would also do is I would permit every American to be part of the congressional plan, which is the best plan, every small business. I'd lower Medicare to 55 instead of 65. I'd give veterans a hero's health card so they could get health care anywhere they want. But, Tom, I'd focus a lot on helping those that can't afford health care with more Medicaid for kids, for low-income people. And then, finally, a major focus on prevention. And that focus on prevention would be getting rid of junk food in schools, as I've done in New Mexico. It'd be also having healthy breakfast for every kid, mandatory phys ed. You know, I'd give incentives to companies to let their workers achieve wellness. And more research in stem cell, cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's. We're a nation that is getting licked by these diseases. And then finally, you know, one-third of our health care dollars doesn't go into direct care. One-third of $2.2 trillion, it goes into administration and HMO overhead and insurance profits and electronic records that don't exist. And what we need is to shift that one-third to deal with the 47 million uninsured, the 17 million underinsured, and the 4 or so million that are eliminated by pre-existing condition, like mental health, which should be given more of a priority than we have. In a nutshell, my plan doesn't produce any new bureaucracies, but it covers everyone over a 3 to 4 year period.
We're talking with Governor Bill Richardson. His website, richardson4forpresident.com. Governor, talking about health care, what you were just describing, you talked about this third of healthcare spending that actually has nothing to do with healthcare. It has to do with, you know, like the $1.7 billion salary that Bill McGuire, the head of United Healthcare, took.
That's right.
Why not simply say Medicare for everybody?
Well, because I think Tom, what that does is it forces people that may be satisfied with their healthcare plan to go into Medicare. I just think we ought to give the American people freedom of choice. And I'm not hostile to single payer. I'm starting to like it a little more, as I find it frustrating that we have to put up with some of these HMO and insurance company profits and regulations and avarice. But at the same time, I just want to give people that choice. And I believe what my plan does is it says, for instance, to insurance companies, 85% of all your premiums that you pay have to go to direct care instead of your overhead or the salaries of your CEOs, as you just mentioned. I'd rather have strict controls on insurance. I think just, Tom, the best thing we need to do with this country is fix a very dilapidated healthcare system that is so over bureaucratic. Before we start changing it dramatically or raising taxes or creating new bureaucracies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're talking with Governor Bill Richardson. Governor, I think that there's a broad consensus among the American people that the middle class is maybe even beyond at risk, that people are experiencing pain, real pain, and a lot of fear, frankly, that they're one job loss away from economic disaster, that they're one illness away from losing their homes. That they're one, frankly, adjustable rate mortgage change away from losing their homes. What are the things that you would do as President of the United States to in the leadership capacity that the President has, to help reinvigorate, rebuild, reclaim the middle class for America?
Well, I would say that I'd be a president for the middle class, but I think we have to, Tom, tackle some of these problems individually. I see this foreclosure issue is getting out of control, threatening the American dream. And covering and threatening more than 1.5 million Americans that have already lost their homes. I think we need some kind of government intervention like we did the savings and loan crisis to ease the plight of homeowners, maybe a moratorium on foreclosures. In addition to that, pensions. I think we need to have portability of pensions, protect people from their basic safety net of their pensions, where today if there's an offshore move by a company or bankruptcy or a merger, pensions are at risk. Now, you know, on a broad front, it's important, in my judgment, to be fiscally disciplined. One of the problems of our economy is so dependent on China and other countries. I would, you know, this is not popular. Over a 4 to 5 year period, a constitutional amendment to balance the budget, line item veto, get rid of corporate welfare. I would also be a nation that invests in science and technology, and that means favoring certain industries that I think are industries of the future, like being green, solar, wind, biomass, biofuels, high-tech, biomedicine. And then lastly, Tom, we got to upgrade our education system so that we're more competitive, particularly in science and math. We got to pay our teachers better. We got to get rid of this No Child Left Behind Act, which is a terrible unfunded mandate. We got to have ways that young people can go to college, and I have a plan where in exchange of 2 years of tuition, 1 year of national service. I just believe there's a whole cluster of new ideas where we send a message to the middle class that their president is on their side and feels their pain and recognizes that we are in a potential recessionary movement. And unless we take aggressive steps that are not just aimed to protect, you know, with this foreclosure issue, the problem has been we let mortgage bankers become loan sharks, and that's why we're in this mess.
Yeah, isn't it at a certain level really what we're seeing is the result of deregulation that sort of started under Carter and then really picked up steam under Reagan when he stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and let all these companies, you know, these mergers and acquisitions, that we need to re-regulate capitalism to make it work properly?
Yes, we do. And at the same time incentivize the kind of capitalism that promises higher wage jobs and clean jobs. And I just really believe this is why I'm emphasizing energy so much, that if we create a whole new technology of renewable sources and fuels to wean ourselves away from foreign oil, that's going to be a lot of new clean technology jobs in retrofitting homes and fuel-efficient vehicles and in solar, wind, biomass technology and panels. That's what we need to do.
Yeah, especially if we can keep those jobs here at home. Would you do that with tariffs or incentives or what?
No, I think those are homebred industries, the ones I mentioned, especially in energy. They wouldn't be outsourced. I think we need to develop our own science and technology base here.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a fine platform, and Governor, I thank you very much
thank
for
you,
coming
Tom.
On our program. It's Richardson4FORPresident.com, the website. Governor Bill Richardson, once again, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And good luck on the campaign trail. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This land is our land, from Nome, Alaska, to the Key West, the Key West Island. Your Constitution is not defective. This land is ruled by the UCC.
By the UCC. So sing it, Daddy.
This land is my land,
because
I can buy land from Kenny Bunkport. To the Texas Highlands.
That's my daddy singing.
From
there.
The rigs of Kuwait.
41
to the Persian Gulf waters. Walker Bush is my dynasty. Go ahead, Slick Willie.
No, I don't travel the ribbons of highway. The way I go now is in the skyway. I made my fortune and I did it my way. But now I am leaving Hillary.
Take one, Henry.
Yes, I am a master agenda seller. That's why I work for David Rockefeller.
That's Henry Kissinger.
Yes, he controls all your country's money. This land is owned by only him.
Okay, I got one. When I was elected, there was a real controversial issue, and all the Gore supporters got all upset because no one could tell who really won the election. But I didn't have to worry because I'm part of the Walker Bush dynasty. Hey, who's that guy?
Hey, let him sing.
Okay.
He's a buddy of mine.
Looks like a Chinaman over there.
And he now owns our country. 51 minutes past the hour. Yeah. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, long time no talk.
Well, thank you for calling. What's up?
Yeah, I noticed that Bill Richardson continues to use exclusively the kinesthetic modality that you tease out in your book, Cracking the Code.
Yeah, I point that out in most of the talks that I give. If you know, when I get, in fact, I will tomorrow night in Santa Monica, about if you look at the various candidates, and this isn't a slam or a praise. This is completely kind of value neutral, but it's like Bill Richardson is so kinesthetic. He's so in his feelings. He always uses feelings predicates, and he must have said, "I feel." 15 times in that interview that we had with him.
Yeah, and I have to say that's why he's growing on me. I'm very kinesthetic, and it really works for me, but I worry about him not connecting with the other 60-70% of America.
Well, connecting is the kind of word that a kinesthetic person would use. The fact of the matter is that people make political decisions more on emotions than they do on logic and rationality. And so if you've got somebody who is capable of communicating kinesthetically, like Bill Richardson can, and frankly like George Bush can, George Bush is highly kinesthetic as well. They will connect with, you know, Joe Sixpack. They will connect with average people at some sort of a visceral level, and that's the level at which most decisions are made. Whether Bill Richardson has the ability to transcend his kinesthesia, his being highly kinesthetic, and also communicate in a verbal and visual way, is frankly, I think, his big challenge. If I was his campaign advisor, I would be teaching him how to use auditory and visual language at the same time that he's using the kinesthetic language that he's most comfortable with. So talking about, you know, his vision for America and how it would look and the story that we should tell ourselves and the story that we always have, you know, held, a kinesthetic person would say, for America, things like that. But interesting point. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call and the opportunity to riff on that. Emily in Santa Cruz. Hey, Emily.
Yes, hello there. I was interested in your conversation with
Governor Richardson.
Richardson. He get along with all the other candidates except for Dennis Kucinich. He's talking about an insurance company health care plan. My God, that's what we have that's so horrible.
Yeah,
where are these people?
Well, this is my concern. Let me just interrupt you briefly, if I may, Emily, and then I'll hand it back to you. When we had John Edwards on the program and he laid out his fairly complex program and then said, and anybody can buy into Medicare. And I said, okay, if anybody can buy into Medicare, and Medicare has a maximum overhead of about 2.5 or 3% because, you know, there's no corporate CEOs being paid and everything, isn't Medicare going to put all the health insurance companies out of business? And his answer, and this is not verbatim, but his answer was, well, yeah, that's the whole idea, basically, you know, but at least there's that, you know, an acceptable period. There would be a transition, and it wouldn't be an immediate, you know, we're going to pull a plug and throw 20,000 people onto the unemployment lines and dislocate an entire industry.
But I can't believe people are so ill-informed that they don't know about John Conyers' bill, of which Dennis Kucinich is the co-author, H.R. 676, which is really enhanced Medicare for all.
Yeah. Well, I'd say my only modification to your comment, Emily, is that Kucinich and Edwards are the only two people who are working to get us to single national single payer health care.
Why isn't Edwards just saying we all have to support H.R. 676, for God's sakes? That's what I'm... My point.
Yeah, well, you'd have to ask him that question.
But if you get on that subject with him at all, maybe ask him, well, have you heard about the bill in Congress that's all ready to go?
Yeah.
Well, there's no point in having it heard, though, before we get a new administration because, you know, Bush would veto it, right?
I think that there is a very real issue, Emily, of if when you're running for president, not for a Democratic candidate, if you can say, I'm in favor of letting people choose whether they want to have their health insurance company or whether they want to have Medicare, that will fly with a lot of independents and Republicans who actually think that there's something just fine about their health insurance company and they want to keep it.
Whereas if you say, I'm
going to force you to give up your health insurance company.
I wonder where those people are.
I'm telling you, they're calling into right-wing talk radio all the time. They're on the block. That is the Republican Party. That's where they're at. Anyhow, Emily, I appreciate the call. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging John Law Jr. on his statement that women's suffrage has made the federal government bloated and ineffective. Can you spell misogyny? Paul Loeb is here, my old friend, on Hillary and the politics of disappointment. Odette Wilkins is going to drop by on the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and H.R. 1955. Plus the best of the rest of the news right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow live in Los Angeles.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.